This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The life of the Black Republican is pretty lonely these days, but it hasn't always been that way. For decades, the party of Lincoln was the easy choice for many African Americans in northern states who felt the Democratic Party was controlled by, quote, devils from below the Mason-Dixon line. And throughout the 20th century, many influential, yet largely unknown, Republican Black leaders steered the party towards civil rights and social justice policies beneficial to Black Americans. But a lot of that support went away as white Republican politicians made the choice to abandon the cause of civil rights over fear of offending and alienating whites. Since that time, the GOP has worked in many states to pass voting laws that have had the effect of keeping blacks away from the polls, and the party's presidential candidates have largely ignored the issues of racial justice and equality that are important to many African Americans. There is, however, one African American in the crowded race for the GOP nomination. Here's Ben Carson responding on MSNBC to the Baltimore riots this April.
I think whenever you find a situation where you have a concentration of people and a lot of poverty, I don't think it's going to matter that much what their race is. We need to deal with the basic economic issues, providing people with a mechanism to climb out of a state of dependency.
Ever since Barack Obama gathered the support of 90% of black voters in 2008, the GOP has talked about a bigger tent that can include more diversity, but can Republicans actually reclaim the title of Party of Lincoln? A new book called The Loneliness of the Black Republican by Leah Wright Rigueur examines some of these ideas. We'll talk with her and others today, and you can join the conversation 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Leah Wright Rigueur is Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, the author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Leah, welcome back to our show. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also joining us today from NPR's Washington headquarters is David Swerdlich. He is an assistant editor for the Washington Post's online Post Everything section in the Sunday Outlook section. Thank you so much, David, for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Let's go back in history a little bit, Leah, first of all, and set up what's covered in your book. Up until the mid-20th century, many blacks were Republican. Why did this change?
So, one word. The easy answer is race. The harder answer and the much longer answer is race and economics. So when we look back, and my book covers roughly a 50-60-year period, a lot starts happening around the New Deal. With Franklin Delano Roosevelt and some of the policies that he puts in place. I mean, it makes tremendous economic gains for African Americans, and that's the first time we really see a shift of black voters into the Democratic Party. And they're there with racists, they're there with segregationists, they're there with labor activists, things like that. We see a real transformation, though, in the 1940s with Truman and the introduction of civil rights and civil rights on a massive scale. And after that, I think we really start to see a shift as African Americans come to find a home in the Democratic Party. And to be honest, a lot of the progressive gains of the last, you know, the 20th century have come from the left, which is why most of the action is on the left and why African Americans tend to be kind of within these liberal circles.
The quote even that we played from Ben Carson at the top of the program suggests one of the things that you address throughout your book and that we're going to be addressing throughout the course of this program, which is this divide almost between the idea that African Americans are only going to vote around issues of race, and that's the way in which we're going to define the African American vote and actually most of the ideals perhaps that they have, versus the idea that black Americans, like everyone else, wants a strong economy, they want to have jobs. And there is this divide. Can you talk about that and where we sort of see this split in the political conversation that African Americans are having?
So here's the interesting thing. Black voters are a lot like other voters yeah. of other races. They're a lot like white voters. They're a lot like Asian voters. They're a lot like Latino voters. The slight difference, however, is that race enters the conversation for black voters almost always. And in fact, part of this has to do with the fact that African Americans can't divorce themselves from their race. So everything, their lived experience, is connected to their race. And so what we end up seeing is that African American voters, even though about a third of the black community have votes, social views that line up with white Republican conservatives, they tend not to vote for the Republican Party. And that's largely because they believe that the Republican Party is not empathetic to African Americans or to African Americans' issues surrounding race.
I want to ask you why this time period, because you talk about the start of this period being around the New Deal, but you go up to 1980. So what's the cutoff there? Why this particular period to explore the idea of Black Republicans?
So it's a fascinating period, largely because there's so much flexibility. And what you see is a lot of people going back and forth. And even though it doesn't seem like it, right, because at the very beginning we talked about how after a certain point, Black voters really are in the Democratic camp. Even despite that, there's a lot of flexibility on the ground with people going back and forth and real possibility up until roughly 1980 or 1981, which happens to coincide with the Reagan Revolution. And that's really where ideological boundaries start being hardened, getting much harder. That flexibility, that elasticity that goes into politics that really defined the middle of the 20th century starts to disappear.
David, I want to bring you into the conversation and ask what you think some of the big themes are as we consider the history of African Americans and the Republican Party. We've addressed a few of them. One of them, of course, has to do with something that Ben Carson and many others talks about, is this bootstraps mentality, this idea that African American Republicans view the largely urban poverty that grips an awful lot of cities in America as something that people can pull themselves out of, as opposed to waiting for a handout, in their words, from a Democratic kind of big brother. That's one of the themes, certainly. Are there other important ones that you see?
Yeah, no, I think that's right there in the mainstream of the discussion. I mean, the concepts of entrepreneurship, self-reliance, self-reliability are not at all new or foreign or out of the mainstream of the discourse that goes on in Black communities. But what you do get is a certain conventional wisdom, not among all folks or not among all Republicans, but among some folks that get this sense that that's not the mainstream discussion in African-American communities. And then you get rhetoric of the kind that Carson might have delivered in that clip you played earlier. And that presents a problem for someone like Carson, who has said openly that part of his appeal is to try and get a certain percentage, something like 15% to 20% of the Black vote to be a viable Republican presidential candidate. But that kind of rhetoric, even if that's a discussion that's worth having, is not the way you lead off if you want to change the margin from, you know, Black voters voting 90% for Democrats to, say, Black voters voting 70 or 80% for Democrats. And the only other thing I wanted to touch on was just to echo what Leah said a moment ago, is that, right, Black voters are like other voters. Black voters have 401ks. Black voters have small businesses. Black voters care about the war in Iraq and about national security. Black voters care about, although diverging from the mainstream, care about healthcare. It's not just issues of race. And I think the Republican Party has had, John, some difficulty messaging that when they've tried to broaden their tent.
Why so much difficulty? I mean, what stands between Republicans and Republican politicians from actually making that message? Because, again, following 2008, what we heard was a Republican Party that said, look, we've got to figure this out. We've got to change. We've got to not talk the way we do about Latinos. We've got to not talk the way we do about African Americans. But yet somehow or other, that message this many years later in this presidential race doesn't seem, David, to be any different.
Yeah, so two easy things. I mean, it has died down and muted now in the waning couple of years of President Obama's tenure. But in President Obama's first term and during his two campaigns for president, there was this tremendous amount, and everyone remembers it, this tremendous amount of really vitriolic rhetoric directed toward President Obama. He's a socialist. He's not one of us. We're taking our country back. And that was coming from not all Republicans, again, but from the right side of the political aisle, from the, you know, so-called Tea Party. And that, I think, was sort of this smokescreen that made it more difficult, even though it was already difficult, for Republicans to say to African-American voters writ large, look, we want some of your vote. We know we're not going to get the majority of the Black vote, but there's got to be a way to get more than 10% of the Black vote. I think the other sort of, you know, thing that goes along with that messaging issue that you described is that, you know, the Republican Party, at least again with its rhetoric and on certain issues like, let's say, healthcare, has not shifted to recognize that the electorate in general, and now I'm speaking a lot about Latino voters, right, has just really changed in the last several, certainly presidential cycles. And that, you know, if you want to get this basic core conservative small government message across to Black and Latino voters, which there is a receptive audience for, that it's got to be couched and spoken in a certain way and not in the way that we've seen in the last X number of years in politics.
Does that sound right to you, Leah?
That's absolutely right. I mean, you know, I often say the phrase, the Republican Party is always going to be judged by the worst of its lot, meaning that the Democratic Party does have its issues with Black voters, with minority voters that it has to overcome, especially getting them to turn out. But it's a totally different beast from what the Republican Party is trying to do. Right? So they're trying to overcome decades, generations of hostile relationships. And so what ends up happening is if what you see is the extremist version of the party, and that extremist version tends to target President Barack Obama in kind of really nasty and visceral ways, and oftentimes racist ways, that is what Black voters are seeing. So it doesn't matter if the rest of the message, you know, is resonating. People are saying, I may support you. I may be a fiscal conservative. I might even be a social conservative. But when I hear you talk about that way about the president, I'm not only saying that you're talking about the president, you're also talking about me. And so that is a powerful barrier to any kind of relationship. And so I think part of what the party has to deal with is really rooting out the racism that, you know, is part of its fringe element and calling it out.
I want to get to, in the next segment, when we bring on a couple of local Black politicians who are part of the Republican Party, to talk about the people who deliver that message, because I think one important piece of this is, no matter what the message, if the message is delivered by other African Americans who are active in politics, it may indeed sound different or be a different message than if it's only coming from overwhelmingly older white men. We'll put that aside for 1 second and just get back to a little bit of history here, too. The Republican Party, Leah, is conservative in many ways, and one of the biggest ways in which it is conservative is that it does tend to look to a patriarchal system. It does tend to look to the past. You make a division in your book around the Goldwater years and the Nixon and the go up to Ronald Reagan. These, in many ways, are seen as the benchmarks for today's Republican Party, and these are some of the same benchmarks that you cite at making this split where Black Republicans didn't want to vote with the party anymore.
Right. So the biggest one is the Goldwater debacle. And it's interesting because Goldwater many years later says, I was wrong, and apologizes for, you know, the actions that really do divide the party in ways that resonate today.
And describe the actions.
And so 1964, you know, the biggest thing is the party has a nominee, Barry Goldwater, who has voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which up until this point is the most comprehensive civil rights act the nation has ever seen. And it just destroys relationships with African Americans who say, I can't be associated with a party that won't even recognize civil rights. It won't recognize the most comprehensive civil rights bill that we have. And it doesn't matter that other Republicans in Congress have voted for and supported. You guys have nominated someone who has gone out of his way to, you know, to push this aside and say this is not necessary. So it doesn't matter how principled Barry Goldwater allegedly was, the fact remains that he voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act and ends up getting, of course, the five deep South states. Those are the only electoral votes that he gets. And I think within the party, it causes African Americans who associate with the Republican Party to say, we can't support this. We absolutely can. And it actually spurs them to create an alternate voice and an alternate path, which sometimes the Republican Party does respond to and other times throws away.
Leah, of course, has the history down cold. David, do you think I make too broad a political point in saying that because in large part the Republican Party of 2015 and 2016 still identifies in many ways with Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon and then later Ronald Reagan, that some of these hard feelings, these things that date back to 1964, these are still held on to by the majority of African-American voters?
Yeah, although I'd make a distinction between the sort of hardcore movement conservatives like a Goldwater or later you see Reagan and what I consider fairly moderate Republicans like Nixon, Ford, you know, your Jacob Javits's, your George Romney's, et cetera, who were not that far apart philosophically from Black conservative or legacy Black Republican voters. I'll just add one thing about Goldwater, although I'll defer to Leah as the historian here, is that, you know, if you read Goldwater's book, Conscience of a Conservative, there's a lot in there, again, in my opinion, that I think there's a sector of the African-American electorate that it would resonate with even today. But as she said, John, I think it's one of those things where the way the message was brought out by Goldwater, the way that conservative and Republican messaging takes place now, even some of the African-American messengers, again, we can go back to Ben Carson, I know, but Ben Carson, again, is a movement conservative guy. It's not pitched to the Black voter, the Black electorate in a way that I think that resonates. I would just say one more thing, and that is that when you're talking about, you know, going back to the Nixon and then Goldwater time frame, you know, you have a landmark moment like Kennedy in 1960, correct me if I'm wrong, calling Coretta Scott King when Martin Luther King was in jail and Nixon sort of, you know, passing on the opportunity to do that. And you have these little moments in that era where slowly but surely the message was taken, whether or not intended, by the African-American electorate, again, writ large. Hey, Democrats, even if we're not with Democrats on every single issue, are making this appeal to the Black vote. And Republicans from that time forward have not done such a good job with it.
So there's, I'm so glad you brought that out. There are these fantastic stories by this guy named E. Frederick Morrow, who actually works for Eisenhower and later works for Nixon, where he talks in his diary about urging Nixon to call the King family while King is in jail during that 1960 incident. And he keeps saying, please call, please call, please call. And what ends up happening, Kennedy calls. And it really shifts the tide of the election. And in fact, in 62, Nixon says, I messed up. That is where I absolutely messed up. And I messed up in not doing more in doing outreach towards African-American communities. Now, this is the Richard Nixon that we all know as Southern strategy Richard Nixon. But here he is in the 62 acknowledging, you know, if we actually did more legwork, we probably could have gotten much more of the Black vote.
We're talking with Leah Wright Regert, and her new book is called The Loneliness of the Black Republican. She joins us in studio today. She's a professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. We're also joined by David Swerdlich, who's an assistant editor for the Washington Post online Post Everything section. He joins us from Washington today. When we come back from a break, we're going to meet a couple of local Black Republicans who are involved in politics as we consider this issue here on Where We Live. You can join us 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're considering The Loneliness of the Black Republican. It's the title of a new book by Leah Wright Regert, who joins us in studio today. We're also joined by David Swerdlich, who's an assistant editor at the Washington Post's Post Everything section. And we're going to be joined now by a few Black Republicans who are active in Connecticut. Andre Baumgardner is a state representative serving the 41st General Assembly District in Groton and New London. Thank you so much for coming in today, sir. I appreciate it.
John, it's great to be with you.
Also joining us by phone today is Wayne Winsley. He is a motivational speaker. He was a 2012 candidate for U.S. Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. Wayne, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So first of all, I want to read a quote, Leah, from you and talk about this. You wrote, all of our instincts, scholarly and otherwise, tell us that African Americans should not be Republicans, nor should they be conservatives. Yet Black Republicans do exist, and their inevitable existence, of course, complicates our assumptions. I like that. I like the way you worded that. But to talk that through a little bit, I mean, one of the things that you address in the book, and we've already talked about with David so far, is that a traditional conservative message is that people vote their own self-interest, is that you vote to support your family, to support your pocketbook, to make sure that you are safe and you can thrive in America. And so one of the conundrums then for many African-Americans is that to vote in their own self-interest really means voting for sometimes a party they might not necessarily agree with, the Democratic Party, but one that has their civil rights, at least historically, through your scholarship in mind. Can you talk that through a little bit? Because I think that's a key divide here that's part of our conversation.
Right. And in fact, a number of studies have actually found that the more money and the more education that African Americans get, the more likely they are to vote for the Democratic Party and actually campaign and work for the Democratic Party, up until a certain point. That 1%, though, is more likely to support the GOP.
The 1%, the 1% that makes the most money?
Or that makes the most money, right.
Yes.
But I think what's going on, though, is that what you're seeing is not just history, right? It's also contemporary events. And we've talked a little bit about this, where a lot of African Americans say, and they look at the political landscape, and they say, I can't bring myself to vote for this political party, and I can't bring myself to do it, especially in times of crisis or when racial tensions are particularly high. And actually, what we see is when things start to even out, when African Americans start to see very little difference between the parties, no difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party on civil rights, you actually see African Americans start to drift into the GOP. Not a huge amount, but significant numbers, especially between the ages of roughly 18 to 34 black men in the South.
So all things being equal on civil rights issues, all of a sudden some of the other things about conservatism start to appeal.
Exactly. And so we have to also remember in this day and age, African Americans are the most religious of any racial group in the country. So some of that social conservatism, some of that religious conservatism actually does appeal to, say, black voters. What ends up happening, though, is when there are moments of racial crisis and the GOP is perceived to act in a particular way during these racial crises. Hurricane Katrina is one example. Barack Obama's election is another. Ferguson is another. We see support for the Democratic Party shoot up and disapproval for the GOP shoot up as well.
Hmm. Andre, I want to ask a little bit about your career and why you're involved in Republican politics, but I'd just like to ask you to maybe comment on what Leah just said. This idea that one of the things that's held back a black Republican movement is really the idea of voting in your own self-interest, and Republicans for the last 40, 50 years have not been the party of civil rights.
Absolutely. Well, take a look at our cities, for example. What role models or elected officials of color do we have? There are none. So you can't make a compelling case to voters without having folks to a certain extent that look like you. So I think moving forward, one thing, especially here in Connecticut, but nationwide, we really need to begin doing is ensuring or reaching out to potential people who want to run for office and say, if you're fiscally conservative or perhaps socially conservative, that there's a spot or place for you in the Republican Party. And I just don't think we're making that case right now.
Okay, so at some point along the way, the case was made to you. Why are you a Republican?
Well, I think, like many others, got their start in politics through mentors. A personal mentor of mine is a former congressman. His wife was my fourth and fifth grade writing teacher, and sort of through that relationship, I got involved with the Republican Party.
Which congressman?
Colonel Rob Simmons. He served in the 2nd Congressional District from 2000 to 2006.
We know him quite well.
I think it's important that, you know, for the folks who want to see the party grow, that they really take the initiative in reaching out to, schools or colleagues, friends, or just people in the community and serve as those mentors. We need more.
You make the case, and I was saying that we were going to get to this point, the idea that a mostly white Republican Party may have a message to appeal to African-American voters, I think probably in your mind, doesn't hold as much weight or as much water as a Republican Party that has at least enough black faces to say, look, this is someone who comes from where I come from, who believes in some of the same things I believe in. How important do you think that is in order to actually garner a larger percentage of the vote, to just have more leadership faces, voices like yours?
I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's our job as policymakers to, or folks who are interested in running for office, to take that story right to the road or to the doorstep. I got elected by knocking on a lot of doors in places that many politicians, or let alone, you know, politicians who sort of, have compelling stories, went to. These are areas that are perhaps economically depressed, and so you wouldn't expect your average politician to knock on their door and say, hey, you need to vote for me, and this is why, and this is what I can do for you. And I don't think enough of that outreach is happening, and it has to happen.
In this idea of actually asking for the vote, one of the long-running stereotypes, and certainly addressed in Leah's book, is this notion that the Democratic Party for years has taken for granted the black vote, right? That over a certain amount of time, because African Americans did not vote for Republicans, mm-hmm. Democrats didn't have to knock on the doors anymore. No one had to actually say, here I am, vote for me, because it was just assumed that if there is a black person in your district that they were going to vote for a Democrat.
And I think to a certain extent, though, the Republican Party has also written off that electorate, and it's a huge mistake. I mean, if you look at municipalities here in Connecticut, Danbury, New Britain, where we have Republican mayors, those individuals, you know, Mayor Mark Bouton, Mayor Aaron Stewart, reached out to voters directly, Latinos, African Americans, and made a case to them that their policies would be and their leadership would be better off for that community. And I think if we had more people do that, if we had more people who were actually representative of minority communities, then I think the Republican Party can certainly grow at an exponential rate.
David Swerdlich, I'm wondering if you can comment on that, this idea that the Republicans may have written off the black electorate at the same rate that the Democrats have taken that same electorate for granted. It seems as though there's in many ways work to be done on both sides.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think Republicans up until very recently and up until the recent efforts of a few people like Senator Rand Paul, who obviously is not an African-American, he's white, but up until very recently, a lot of Republicans have not tried to earn the black vote. And I specifically use the word earn because, right, voters want to feel, regardless of party, ideology, or demographic group, like you're working for their vote. But I think, John, that it actually also goes past the messaging issue that we've been talking about and to the issues themselves, right? African Americans, even those who consider themselves conservative, tend to see certain issues differently than when you poll other demographic groups of voters. For example, African Americans were 85% against the Iraq War from the start, not after it went bad, but from the start. African Americans still today, 75% in polling favor the Affordable Care Act, which, by the way, was the Governor Romney's, you know, mass care plan writ large across the United States. And then if you go back to legacy Republicans like Senator Ed Brooke from Massachusetts, who was a black Republican representing Massachusetts in the Senate in the 70s, who was the last black man in the U.S. Senate prior to Barack Obama, he was a co-sponsor of the Fair Housing Act as a Republican. You know, he was a Nixon guy, a Rockefeller guy, and that was the sort of lane of Republicanism that he was in, and that I think resonated more with that 30% of the black electorate that Leah's book sort of touches on. That you don't see now from, say, a leading black conservative like a Ben Carson.
I want to bring in Wayne Winsley into the conversation and ask you, first of all, Wayne, what brought you first into the Republican Party?
Life experience really brought me into the Republican Party. When I was 18 years old, I registered to vote. I registered as a Democrat because I was black. It's what you did. But as I began to look around me and get work experience and started to really pay attention to things political, I realized that I simply agreed more with the philosophies and values of the Republican Party. One of the formative things, moments in my life when I lived in the Garden Valley Housing Projects in Cleveland, Ohio, and one of the things I saw looking out my window Friday, on a Saturday, Sunday, was people washing their cars and cleaning their cars just like in any town USA on a weekend. And I asked myself the question, why do they care so much about the cars? Meanwhile, because the apartments are trashed, the screen doors are hanging off, there's broken windows everywhere. And later, I realized the answer. The answer was, because they own the car. They actually had to buy the car with their own money. That's why they care for it. The housing authority has to fix the windows or the doors, so it doesn't matter. And it's ideas like that that have continued to resonate throughout my life and kind of form me into the person that I am today. And, you know, we I'm listening to the conversation, and Leah and David, I mean, you guys have brought up some really great points. And I would offer three pieces of advice for today's Republican Party, especially here in Connecticut. Show up and share a message of help and support. You have to acknowledge the fact that, you know what, especially, you know, here in Connecticut, we've been gone a while, but we're back and we're here to help, because the people that live in the places like New Haven, where I campaigned as a Republican in 2012, they know what the situation on the ground is. I've had people tell me, you know, our current representatives, they don't really come here. They, you know, but at least they act like they care. Even if they really don't, they act like they're, so we vote for them. I got more African-American votes out of New Haven probably than any Republican, probably since maybe Jody Rell, because everybody loves Jody Rell, but by simply showing up and sharing a message of hope and support.
And that was in one of the, I think, issues with your campaign, and unfortunately the issue for, this is a GOP issue, Wayne, that goes beyond African-Americans in the Republican Party. It's that the Republican Party hasn't done a very good job in races like yours against Rosa DeLauro with actually helping its candidates to mount real campaigns. And in many ways, I think a lot of observers like myself see a candidate like you kind of thrown to the dogs without a whole lot of help from either the national or the local Republican Party. Did you feel as though the GOP helped you in your attempt to unseat a very popular Democrat in the New Haven area?
No, because that district has been written off as unwinnable by a Republican. Just like, as was pointed out during our conversation, the African-American vote by some Republicans has been written off, which is why the conversation today, when we talk about the demographic that's being competed for, the Hispanic vote is being competed for by both Republicans and Democrats right now. You don't hear that same conversation in terms of the African-American vote because the Democrat has taken it for granted because we own it, and the Republican has written it off as unreachable when it's actually not true.
I want to just let our listeners know that you can call 860-275-7266 and join our conversation as we talk with Wayne Winsley and David Swerdlick, Andre Baumgartner, and Leah Wright-Ruger. Let's go to Derek, who's calling from Windsor. Derek, always good to hear from you. What's on your mind?
Hey, good to talk to you too, John. You're my buddy, man. All right. Let me just say I'm listening to your panel, and I am a guy on the street, and, you know, unless you go on the street, it's like a reporter reporting second-hand news. So I said that to say I'm seeing and hearing everything out here. I am an African-American. I have a lot of friends. And basically the problem, one of the problem, is that when I talk to a lot of my friends, and I am the same, I'd never vote for a Republican. Most of my friends, you couldn't pay them to vote for a Republican. You could not pay them. And because, I don't know if it's become a stigma, but it's like when you say Republican, most of the people I know think of the Republican as rich white folks who cannot relate to not just African-American, but, you know, just minority in general. And, for example, the Obamacare, which, you know, I think a lot of my friends and blacks are in for, the Republicans are objecting to that. Minimum wage, a lot of things that really affect minorities, as I said, not just African-American. The Republicans don't seem to be on board with those things. So therefore, you know, it's either my friends or people that I know stay room when it's time to vote, or they vote Democrat. And I don't know if that will change in the near future, but these are some of the problems that I see, John.
Well, Derek, thank you as always for your phone call. And Andre, I think he raises a few really interesting points there. And one of the main ones is this isn't just Black Americans who think this. A lot of Americans think this, that the Republican Party is the party of rich white guys. I mean, Mitt Romney is, in many ways, he symbolizes the rich white guy who talks about, you know, the 47% of people, et cetera, et cetera. So for a Republican like you, I mean, how do you get past that? Because that is, in many ways, people's view, and in many ways, it's people's reality.
Well, I think we need to put up candidates who are more relatable to everyday working people, people who, you know, the lady who owns the bodega on the corner of, you know, of the street in Hartford. I mean, you know, so many different people, I think, are just feel disenfranchised by the GOP because, like you said, we're putting up candidates who cannot relate to you know, everyday people. So I think moving forward, we really need to start recruiting candidates who have a diverse array of experiences, of life experiences and economic backgrounds. And I think, you know, the results show that when Republicans put up those candidates, we're successful. So, you know, I think someone like myself certainly isn't ubiquitous throughout, you know, Republican politics or, you know, politics in general within our state. But I think we need to start heading that direction if the Republican Party wants to win and stay relevant.
Well, and Lee, I think it is a bigger issue. We've talked actually about Latinos, women as well. I mean, there is a sense that the Republican Party has just not been as welcoming to people who aren't rich white men for years and years and years. I mean, does the history bear that out, or is that just the perception right now in 2015 as we see a slate, for instance, of Republican presidential candidates with one black man and a whole bunch of white guys clamoring for votes and actually saying things that are really, really appealing to a base Republican voter?
Right. So absolutely. This has been a long-standing problem with the GOP. I mean, there's a fascinating history out there of the Republican Party's efforts to include quotas for women in the 1970s, right? So saying we have a woman problem, so let's try and actually bring more people into the party. But this is, I mean, it's the cycle of American politics. Every couple of years, this comes back up. And, you know, the party had in 2012 and in 2008 those kind of, we need to do something about our woman problem, our poor people problem, our Latino problem, you know, all of these things. But it's the same. It's almost identical to the report that they do in 1976, that they do in 1966, that they do in 1960, that they do in 1956. I mean, I could go on and on. But this is a long-standing problem. And part of it actually may have to do with the very principles of individualism that the Republican Party champions.
Hmm. Andre, you want to jump in real quick?
I do want to step in a little bit. I think that's still a problem because we continue to do it, or we have candidates that are alienating significant number of different voters. And, you know, when you have a candidate like Donald Trump making comments
exactly
left and right, I mean, that are truly offending everyone, it's a problem. And I think it's our job, especially as, you know, someone who is an elected official, to call people out on that.
Well, and Wayne, I wanted to ask you this last thing. We have to take a break soon, but I do want to ask you about the Republicans who are in the field right now, somebody like Donald Trump, maybe others, have said things that might be offensive to some African Americans. But I think almost as importantly, the leaders of the Republican Party right now, who are mostly white, have not, I don't think, said incredibly substantive things in the wake of Ferguson and Baltimore and a series of other important issues that are important not just for African Americans, but are important for America. It's like race is the issue that we're grappling with more than anything else in 2015. And Wayne, I don't know about you, but I'm not hearing the Republican leadership talk about that in a way that makes a whole lot of sense.
You're absolutely right. And two things that we can do right now to start to counter the 40 years of bad press that the GOP has gotten, and deservedly so, because they haven't countered it. Number one, talk about breaking the cycle of poverty. I've had somebody ask me, well, Wayne, what do you say to a third-generation welfare recipient who is, they're not going to do anything, they've got their benefits and stuff like that? I said, you know what? I'll bet that person, even though they may have given up on anything else for themselves, I bet they'd love for their children to do better. Talk about how we can help break the cycle of poverty through some of the things, the values that we actually share, you know. Or how about this? Show up and support efforts that promote and showcase the values that we both share.
But I think part of it, though, too, is actually speaking about those things, but also acknowledging, for instance, a reality of many black Americans, which is that police treat them differently than they treat white people. I mean, if that was something that was addressed substantively by the Republican Party, I think a lot of African American voters would stand up and listen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we do have to stop pretending that racism doesn't exist. As a black man in America, and here in Connecticut, is racism behind every rock and corner? No. But does it exist? Yes. Have I actually been profiled by police? Yes. But I've also been helped by officers who went out of their way to help me, regardless of the fact that I'm black, because I'm a citizen. So we have to be able to speak realistically and stop acting like it doesn't exist, and simply be real. Don't be afraid to talk to people like folks.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
Yes. I walk around. Here's my campaign pitch. I walked around the streets of New Haven, and I said simply, I'm Wayne. I'm running for Congress. I'd like to help more of our neighbors go from food stamps to full-time employment, and I'd like to do that by helping especially our local businesses be able to succeed better, because for people to get off food stamps, there has to be a job for them, and I'd love to see more of our young people graduating from school fully educated and prepared for the modern workforce. Done.
Wayne Winsley is a motivational speaker who is a 2012 candidate for U.S. Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
When we continue our conversation, we'll come back with Leah Wright Regeer, whose book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, got us started thinking about this issue in a new way. Andre Baumgartner, who's a state representative who serves the 41st General Assembly District, and also David Swerdlick from The Washington Post. When we come back, we're going to talk more about race issues and how that might play into some of our conversation. Take more of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, Medicaid turns 50 this month. It's changed a lot since Lyndon Johnson signed it into law back in 1965, especially since the Affordable Care Act made it the health insurer for millions of previously uninsured. We'll take a look at Medicaid today. That's coming up on the next Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking with Leah Wright Regeer, who's assistant professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government and the author of a new book called The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Also joining us today is the Washington Post's David Swerdlick and Andre Baumgartner, who's a state representative from the Groton and New London area. Quickly, I want to go to the phones. Bonita is calling from New Haven. Hi there, Bonita.
Hi. I'm calling because I just wanted to say that many blacks see many issues through the lens of race, and the GOP spends most of their time denying that race exists. So right there you have a problem. Mm. Economic solutions without acknowledging that there's racism is not helpful to most blacks who are having issues, because you will find that you cannot get around, a lot of the economic issues without also discussing and trying to head on get around racism. And that's the problem with the GOP versus black people. Also, local GOPs may understand that, the local Republican parties, but it doesn't seem that the national party understands that. And so what you find is a local GOP may be very good for some, whatever community they are trying to represent. However, when you look at the entire party, it doesn't represent or help blacks. And it's, it seems like it's a us versus them, that a lot of the GOP see black people as trying to take things away from other people.
Well, Benita, you raise a lot of – thank you very much for your phone call. And you raise a lot of great points, as always. And I guess I want to go first to David. We only have a few minutes left, but this notion that we were talking about just before the break that I think Benita brings up as well, that as long as the Republican Party, at least at the national level, seems to, whether it's on Fox News or it's the top presidential candidates, deny that things that include racism – actually have racism involved, that's going to be a huge barrier. I mean, is there any way to get over that? I mean, doesn't that just have to change substantively first?
I think it does have to change substantively. And in terms of what Benita was saying, clearly she's passionate, right? And clearly a lot of people feel that way. I would say I think that there are people within the Republican Party who do sincerely want to reach out to the African-American electorate. But if you look at some of the issues, and this is what we were talking about before the break or what Wayne was talking about, there's this huge hurdle that Republicans, the national party, has to overcome. For instance, Wayne was talking about campaigning to people door to door and saying, hey, look, I want to help people get off of food stamps. And what I think a lot of African-American voters say is, OK, fine. But do you also want farmers to get off of farm subsidies? You know, is there a consistent small government message, or are you small governmenting black voters? I think you also have a situation, John, you brought up Mitt Romney. This guy was in a tough position. Look, he told this story in 2012. I'm sure your listeners remember about in 1978 when he was a younger man. And as a Mormon, he told the story that he pulled over to the side of the road in his car and wept because the Mormon church finally allowed black men to be priesthood holders. But he was fighting upstream so hard, John, against this entire narrative that Leah's book lays out about how African-Americans don't have this. There's this trust gap between black voters and the Republican Party that even that kind of heartfelt story doesn't resonate. And I think that's the challenge that they're facing.
And the other thing that Benita talks about is this local versus national split. Andre, you see this every day, and I talk about this all the time in my show. Local politics, Republicans and Democrats get together. They got to fix the roads. They got to make stuff happen. You go up to the national level, it's an entirely different conversation. I think one of the problems with your party right now as far as local versus national is there's a message going out from Rush Limbaugh and others that sounds one way, and there's people on the ground who are trying to do something very differently. And how do you overcome that?
Well, I think those individuals really need to tone down the rhetoric. I think it's way too polarizing. It really does disenfranchise a significant number of minority voters. I think a lot of Republicans cannot meet the litmus test for what is known to be a traditional Republican. I think, for me personally, I would describe myself as fiscally conservative, but have a socially progressive, libertarian, social issue side of me. And so I think we really need to go that route. I co-sponsored the governor's Second Chance Bill because it was smart policy. We incarcerate too many people, and it's the fiscally conservative thing to do or fiscally responsible thing to do. And I think until Republican voter or Republican elected officials start acknowledging that, I think that's when we can really start seeing successes, not just in this state, but nationally.
Well, you know what? There's a couple of minutes left, and Andre brings us, I think, to a perfect thing to finish with, Leah, is there's an issue right there where Republicans and Democrats are starting to rally together and say, the way in which we incarcerate this ungodly number of young black men in our prisons, we pay an awful lot for it, and we have almost no good social outcomes afterward. That has to change. And your book is a history book about, during a lot of that history, that's when we wrote the laws, both Democrats and Republicans, that started the mandatory minimums that put so many young black men in prison. Is this a way for the Republican Party to start to say, yeah, this is a part of the civil rights heritage we're going to start to claim back? We're going to actually say, yeah, we don't think there should be so many young black men in prison.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is what Rand Paul, who started off, being booed at Howard, has gradually been working his way up to. And I think it's a fragile coalition, but it's a coalition nonetheless. It's bipartisan. It has most, support from all corners of Congress. And it's exciting. And I think this is the kind of thing, I teach policy classes. This is the kind of thing that we talk about when we say there has to be actual policy that people can get behind. It can't just be rhetoric. And it can't just be politicians going in and say, hey, you people of color, this is what you guys need to do. It actually has to be people listening and saying these are the issues. And OK, this is how we're going to get our ideology of conservatism to work with the issue, the very real issues facing you and your community.
Jumping right off of that, our friend Dr. Kalila Brown, dean from Quinnipiac, tweets at us, increasing GOP outreach to communities of color is a hollow prize without substantive policy change. Must be more than just branding, she writes, and I think
exactly.
You would agree. Leah Wright Rugger's book is The Loneliness of the Black Republican, and she is from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks also to State Representative Andre Baumgartner. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, John.
And thanks to David Swerdlick, who's assistant editor for the Post's online Post Everything Second section. Thank you so much, David. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John.
Our program today produced by Betsy Kaplan. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.